but fear of living a meaningless life. And when we're concerned about that and don't want to live a meaningless life, then we will put our energy into what's important, transforming our mind, because it's our mind and its habits and tendencies and the karmic imprints on it that go with us from one life to the next. So all the comfort around us now is very nice and it seems very real, but in a flash it could disappear, and one day it will disappear in a flash. And all the people around us, our whole little environment, our body, our belongings, our status, our prestige, our community, the whole thing evaporates in front of us. And we enter into the intermediate stage, surrounded by our karmic view, our karmic vision, which is dependent upon the actions that we've done. So sometimes on a daily basis, if we look at what our karmic view is, what our karmic vision is, and we're aware of how our mind creates stories, how our mind projects, how our mind gets upset when there's nothing external there that's actually provoking it, but simply the mind projecting things. When we get an idea of how that happens on a day-to-day basis, then we become really concerned about it happening at the time of death and in the future life, where we're going to have even less opportunity to control our mind than we do nowadays. Because now we're healthy, we've heard the teachings, and yet still our mind makes up all these fantasies. So what's going to happen when we're actually separating from this body? And the mind starts making fantasies then. Are we going to have the strength of mind to be able to realize that and counteract it? So when we really think about this in terms of our own mind, we get quite concerned about the future we're creating for ourselves. And even though we might talk a lot about bodhicitta and admire bodhicitta, if we can't even manage our mind, our bodhicitta is kind of a joke. So it's quite important that we work with our own mind and what it's projecting, all the stories it's making up that it believes in, and try and remedy those now, while we're alive and healthy, and start to set some new patterns in our mind. And then when we do so, our bodhicitta will really mean something. And so let's make the determination to do that. Again, not just for our own benefit, but for the benefit of everybody. So that the continuity of this mind, independence upon which the label I rests, will be able to work for the benefit of all beings in the future. So folks, it's really easy to forget what practicing Dharma means, isn't it? So it's always very, very important for us to really come back to what our present reality is and what we're trying to do, and the whole Buddhist view so we understand the Four Noble Truths, and especially this thing of how our mind is making up stories. You know, we're not just studying the Dharma and learning, you know, this radiates here and that absorbs there, and there are 16 kinds of emptiness unless you want to divide them into 18, and there's also the subdivision into 20. You know, that's all very nice. But if, you know, on a day-to-day basis, our mind is just projecting mountains of garbage on top of everybody else, and we're totally oblivious to it, and instead we think that all of our projections are real, then we haven't even scratched the surface of what Dharma practice means. Okay, so it's really important to always just look at our own mind and see what's going on in it. And really practice, you know, in a very practical way, a very day-to-day way. And, you know, because, you know, especially us, you know, Mahayana, oh yeah, all sentient beings. And I'm doing, taking and giving meditation, I'm sending out all... everything I own, I'm sending out to all the sentient beings, and now they're enlightened. Oh, that's so wonderful. And I'm Manjushri, radiating light, and, you know, everybody's now saved. And then, you know, we get up from our cushion, and, you know, we start flipping through the mail order catalog and buying this and that and the other thing without even any awareness in our own mind of our own greed and attachment. Yeah, or we start, you know, getting upset at this person and that person because they're not doing this and that and not paying enough attention to us and not appreciating us and blah, 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 you know. And we totally believe that hallucination. Yeah, 100% believe it. We're justified. That person's wrong. So therefore, I'm radiating light to them because they're so confused. Isn't it? You know? We're having this quarrel, and I'm right and they're wrong, so I'm so magnanimous, I do Chenrezig meditation and fill them with light so that they can see the way. Which is my way. I'm right. Yeah, see how compassionate I am? I don't criticize them. I send light rays to them. And then they convert and, you know, do what I want them to do. Okay, so there's lots of little ways that we have of fooling ourselves when we're practicing. That's why it's always, you know, very, very important just to really, you know, check up what's going on in our mind. And especially when our mind starts to spin off, which it does quite regularly. You know, into one hallucination or another. You know, one week it's the jealousy hallucination, next week it's the arrogance one, then it's the attachment, then it's the poor me, you know. So just be able to recognize all of this, that it's coming from our mind, you know, and that that is what ignorance is about. Now, ignorance is that mind that projects all that stuff based on, you know, this solid me. And self-centeredness is the mind that believes that this solid me, you know, needs happiness and deserves happiness more than anybody else in the world. The purpose of my life is to knock down my enemies and protect my friends. Yeah. I mean, isn't that the example we see around us in the world? So we just do the same thing. So this is what we have to start to question, you know. When we're practicing Dharma, we're really questioning some of the basic, you know, fundamental assumptions upon which we live our life. And it's, you know, very important to do this. If we don't do it, then Dharma just becomes some nice little kind of decoration and, you know, pretty drawings. But it doesn't really touch our heart, doesn't really have much effect. Okay. So while we have this precious human life, and, You know, while we have the opportunity to practice the Manjushri meditation, then it's very good to do that, especially because Manjushri is the Buddha of wisdom. And by doing this practice, our wisdom will increase and we'll be able to combat the ignorance that creates all these fantasies. Okay, so we should put some effort into doing that. Okay. So we've been going through the sadhana. We started out with refuge in bodhicitta, so we know what practice we're doing and why we're doing it. Then we meditated on emptiness. And again, this is the key to the whole practice, even though there's just, you know, Om Sabhava Shuddha Sava Dharma Sabhava Shuddha Hum. You know, one little bit there. It doesn't look long. That's where we stop. Yeah, just because there's places with a lot of words doesn't mean that we spend more time there, and places with few words we spend less time. Yeah, but we should actually stop and do some meditation on emptiness, because if we don't, then our visualization becomes very much like a little kid pretending they're Mickey Mouse. You know, because we haven't touched the fundamental grasping at the I. So instead of it being I, you know, with our present identity, it's now I as Manjushri. Yeah. So respect me because I'm Manjushri. Yeah. So it's very important to meditate on emptiness there and really challenge that old fundamental view. And then also to recognize that everything that appears after this, this whole self-generation process, is a meditation on the unity of dependent arising and emptiness. This whole practice, I keep saying this, this whole practice is a meditation on the union of emptiness and dependent arising. Okay, that nothing inherently exists, but within that lack of inherent existence, now everything appears. So we don't fall to the extreme of non-existence by thinking nothing exists, but instead we just remember that inherent existence is what doesn't exist. And we don't fall to the other extreme of permanence or eternalism by thinking that things are inherently existent, and instead we see that they're dependent arising. Okay, so it's important when we say these words that we have some idea of what inherent existence means, because otherwise it's too easy just to get into the jargon. Oh yes, everything's empty of inherent existence, what's next? You know, but somebody says, well, what's inherent existence? And we kind of go, it just means that something's really solid, that's all. Well, you know, we have to get a little bit more in depth than that. You know, what is it that we're negating? Okay, we have the attitude that grasps an inherent existence, and we have the appearance of inherent existence. Yeah, the appearance of inherent existence is an obscuration to omniscience. It's called a cognitive obscuration. And that is what appears to our senses. Okay, which means that everything that we perceive through our senses is false. Okay? The view we have through our senses, things do not exist the way they appear. Which means we are living in a 100% hallucination without taking drugs. Okay? Because we think that everything's out there, some kind of solid entity with its own essence, its own thing that makes it, real, objective, totally unrelated to my mind, totally unrelated to causes and conditions, just there with its own essence. That's how things appear to us, to our sense consciousness, to our mental consciousness, and we believe that. Okay, so that's wrong. Yeah, our whole idea of who we think we are is wrong. Sit with that one for a while, you know. because we're also always saying I this and I that. Our whole idea of who I is wrong. Okay. So things appear incorrect, falsely to us, and then our mind grasps at these false appearances as true. So that's the self-grasping ignorance, that's a consciousness, and that is an obscuration to liberation. Okay, it's a deluded obscuration, so it's eliminated first. So we have to see, you know, what this grasping, the object that this grasping is grasping at, yeah, and prove to ourselves that no such thing can exist. So it's not just a thing of, you know, blank-minded meditation, not thinking about anything, because that's very nice, you don't think about anything, but it doesn't disprove, you know, it doesn't prove that the object that the self-grasping ignorance is holding is false, is wrong. It doesn't prove that. It's just ignoring the whole situation. Yeah, you stay in your little meditative bliss, which is very nice, but we're not really challenging the whole view we have of who we are and what everything is. So we need to, you know, take out the objects that that view is grasping at, all those inherently existent objects, and prove to ourselves that it's not possible for those things to exist as they appear to us. And what that does is that creates a feeling of a lack of inherent existence. We realize the absence of inherent existence. So it's a non-affirming negative. And there's no appearance of conventional phenomena to the mind at that time when we're meditating on emptiness, you know, with direct perception. Within that space of emptiness, yeah, then things can arise. So because things do not inherently exist, therefore they can exist. Sit with that one, okay? Because they don't inherently exist, they can exist. If they did inherently exist, if they had their own essences and independent things that were them, it would be impossible for them to exist because they would exist without depending on causes and conditions. So how did they get produced? And how did they change if they're independent from causes and conditions? Okay, so if things inherently existed, they could not exist at all. Because they're empty, therefore they can exist. So exist means dependently exist. So this whole thing that we're doing of visualizing ourselves as Manjushri is a meditation on dependent existence. Okay, there's no solid I that's becoming Manjushri. All there is an appearance. You know, we start out with the seed syllable, you know, and then from the seed syllable comes the whole deity. And the deity is just an appearance. Yeah, I as Manjushri exist just at the level of appearance. There is no real Manjushri there. So that Manjushri exists dependent on causes and conditions, dependent on parts, and dependent upon the mind that has that. Like hooks, you know, when you do those drawings that draw the numbers together, that connect the numbers. Remember when you were a kid, drawings that connect the numbers, and you get something. Our mind is like that. There's all these parts, and our mind connects the dots, and then we go, oh, Manjushri. Yeah, so you can see, you know, like when you're doing those line drawings as a kid, there's just all these things, and then all of a sudden, you're looking at the same thing you were looking for at before, but all of a sudden you see Manjushri there, and you didn't see it before. Why not? It's only because now your mind has the idea of Manjushri, and has that label, you know, and imputes that on that line drawing. Well, except now it's not the line drawing, it's the collection of the aggregates. Yajna, so based on having the body and mind of Manjushri, we impute, or based on having an enlightened body and mind, we impute Manjushri, we impute I. But there's no I that is Manjushri. Okay? It's just an appearance. So Manjushri is an appearance. Manjushri's body is simply an appearance. It's only because you've joined all the lines and put the arms and legs and all these things together and called it Manjushri's body that that appears to your mind and that we say that exists. If there were no mind perceiving that and connecting the dots, so to speak, and giving the label, or if there were no parts there, then, you know, that whole thing wouldn't exist at all. So the things exist depending on the mind, depending on the conception and the label that's given to it. So as we go through this whole self-generation process, you know, we're meditating on dependent arising and how things arise in those three ways, okay? Dependent on causes and conditions, dependent on parts, dependent on the conception and label. So there you are, you know, Manjushri with your sword and your, you know, your prajna, your lotus with your Prajnaparamita text, you know, with a body of light. Yeah. So it's not this flesh and bones body, because we've realized that this flesh and bones body is a false appearance and it's dissolved into emptiness. Now, and what's appeared after that is a rainbow body. Okay, so it has no, you can't touch it. You know, your body in Manjushri is totally intangible. It's like at Disneyland, the ghost that sits next to you when you come out of your ride, you put your hand right through the ghost. You know, it's there and you see it, but your hand goes right through it. Well, now it's the same with yourself, you know. That's the kind of body you have, just a body made of light. So when you're sitting there meditating on Manjushri, you can't go, oh, I have a stomach ache, you know, because there's just light there. There's no solid stomach. Yeah, my knees hurt, my back hurts, you know. I want to take a bath. I want to go to sleep. Now, you're identifying now with Manjushri's body of light, not with this body. So it's very interesting to see if you can get that feeling, you know, loosen the concept of this body and the attachment to the sensations of this body and try and get a feeling of having a body made of light. And try and get a feeling of having a mind that's enlightened. So when you're meditating on Manjushri, you can't just sit there and go, oh, my family doesn't love me, you know, oh, my boyfriend, my girlfriend, because, you know, I mean, when you visualize the tree of assembled, you know, the merit field, are they sitting there, you know? Is that what they're all discussing when you take refuge? Oh, I have these disciples and they're just, you know, you can't believe it. You know, Gyalsabjay saying to Kedrabjay, oh, my disciples are just too much. So Kedrabjay saying, well, you know, you should see these people that are coming to my class. Oh. And they're like, okay, well, look at the whole society. The whole society's totally screwed up, you know. Kind of what, none of them appreciate us. We're sitting here on the field of merit and they just walk by and don't even say hello. You know, who do they think they are? You know, we work so hard and attain enlightenment for their benefit. And look how much they're showing their gratitude towards us now. You know, so somehow if we're identifying with a mind, you know, an enlightened mind, we can't get into our usual self-pity trips. Yeah, it just doesn't hang together. So when you're doing the meditation on Manjushri and visualizing yourself as Manjushri, and you carry that appearance, you know, and that divine dignity with you into the break time, then watch all your, you know, habitual mental patterns and what your mind thinks and what your mind projects on the world, and ask yourself, is this an accurate view given that I'm an enlightened being? Okay? And what that mind, how it obsesses about different things, you know? Because we all have our own little things that we obsess about. Some of us obsess about our body. Some of us obsess about our social situation. Some of us obsess about our interpersonal relationships. Some of us, you know, obsess about our fame and gain. And we'll just sit there and obsess. And, you know, in the middle of your obsession, try and get distracted and say to yourself, is this what Manjushri would be thinking about? Yeah? And then you come to, you know, have a little bit of a sense of humor because, you know, clearly Manjushri wouldn't have all this rubbish going through his mind. Yeah? So we learn to laugh at ourselves and we learn to let go of some of this garbage without taking it so seriously. Okay? So, you know, they talk a lot in the tantric practice that you're supposed to see, this is in the break time as well as your meditation session, but especially the break time, see all appearances around you as Manjushri in the Pure Land. Think of all sounds as mantra and think of all your thoughts as, you know, Manjushri's omniscient mind. So, you know, what that means is, like I was saying, you know, think of your body as a body of light instead of this, you know, poor conception body of I can't meditate because my stomach hurts. Where's mommy? You know? So you change that view. And, you know, identify with a body of light. And when you look at other sentient beings, instead of looking at them and seeing them as ordinary, you know, and, oh, that one's really good looking, I want to talk to that one, and that one, ugh. You know, and just letting the judgmental mind go, instead of doing that towards everybody around you, think of everybody as Manjushri. So if you want to, you can think of all of them walking around with, you know, golden bodies made of light. Or even more, you know, more so, what you can do is just recognize that you're on the basis of their Buddha potential, you're labeling Manjushri. And so you're seeing them not for the relative karmic bubble that's just temporary and very superficial and illusory, but you're looking deeper and seeing that they have this clear light nature of mind, you know, in a relative and an ultimate sense, and you relate to them and respect them for that. And if you can do that, then you'll have lots of respect for the people around you. And so especially people who are doing retreats, you know, instead of thinking, oh, well, these people are cooking me lunch and these people are cleaning up after me. Now, they're all here to work for me. You know, gringo Americana that I am. Really see, no, you know, there's Buddha potential here. You know, these are living beings with Buddha potential that are appearing as karmic bubbles, as sentient beings. But, you know, you're looking into their Buddha potential and on the basis of that labeling Manjushri and seeing them as Manjushri. And if you see them that way, then of course you're going to have a lot of respect and deference and affection for them. Okay? So that automatically helps with our interpersonal relationships with people. Because instead of projecting other rubbish on them, you know, if we see them as having the Buddha nature, as being Manjushri, then our whole view of them changes and we're going to get along with them more better. We're going to get along with them better because we treat them better. Yeah, when you treat other people like stupid sentient beings, they act like that. When you treat them like Buddhas, they might act better. Yeah. I heard this great story when I was in Singapore. Somebody at this forum that I was participating in told it. So this couple was married, and then their marriage went really bad. And the wife came in to the counselor and said, you know, I can't stand living with my husband anymore. You know, I just can't stand him. And says, I want a divorce. And the counselor said, well, if you divorce him, that's exactly what he wants. You know, you'll make him happy. The wife says, no way, I'm going to stay married to him then. No way am I going to make him happy. So I'm staying married. So then the counselor says, okay, if you really want to, you know, make it rough on him, you really want to hurt him, be really, really nice to him, you know. Be very sweet, be very considerate, talk nicely, have good conversations with him, you know, because he'll fall in love with you again, you know. So the woman went home and did that. And, you know, because she was very excited about it, because she thought, okay, he'll fall in love with me all again, and then I'll divorce him, and that will really get back at him for everything, how awful he treated me. So she went home, and she started treating her husband so nice and so considerate, and sure enough, he fell in love with her all over again. And then she came back to see the counselor, and the counselor said, well, you know, how about filing for the divorce papers? And the wife said, oh, we're getting along so well, I don't want to get divorced. But I thought, you know, it's, do you see the purpose of the story? Okay, so it's the same kind of thing, you know, if you see other people as stupid and treat them that way, they become that. If you see them well, you know, and treat them respectfully, then the whole relationship's going to change. Mm-hmm.
I just had a question about when Manjushri appears, you know, the deity and then all the light, and then Manjushri appears, and then Manjushri disappears, and then reappears, right, after the rainbow light disappears, and then reappears at some point in the sadhana. I was wondering if that's to reaffirm the emptiness?
You mean at the,
Right after the mantra?
Right, at the end, after the mantra. Then we'll get to this, but I guess we'll get to it now and not in order. But, you know, you radiate out light to the whole universe and the sentient beings, you know, and that is to reaffirm that they're all Manjushris and they're all a pure land. Then all that dissolves into you, into the D. It all dissolves into emptiness, and then you reappear as Manjushri, and that's, again, is reaffirming the emptiness and reaffirming you appearing in the break time in the form of Manjushri.
Okay. What is Manjushri thinking?
Well, I'm getting there, okay, because I was right now talking about seeing all sentient beings in the environment. So the same way, yeah, you see sentient beings as Manjushri, you see the environment as a pure land. And so then, you know, you train your mind to think that what you see around you is beautiful. Okay. Instead of, you know, looking at the one spot of dirt and complaining about that, look at everything that's very nice around you. Okay. So Seattle weather is terrific, isn't it?
Yeah.
It'll be much easier when we get to Mexico. Yeah. But you know, we see the environment as a pure land and see some beauty in what's around us, okay, instead of developing the complaining, critical mind. Then the second part where it says, see all sounds as mantra, it doesn't mean that when you're talking to other people or hearing sounds that, you know, the only conversation is, oh, Maripatsana D, you know. Somebody looks at you and says, oh, Maripatsana D, and you go, oh, Maripatsana D, oh, Maripatsana D, you know. Actually, it could be interesting to do it that way. Couldn't it? Yeah? You know? Did you feel like talking in your retreat? You know? Your roommate's still sleeping, you go, oh, my God. So it doesn't mean that that's literally what everybody's saying, but it means that you see the sounds as something beautiful. Okay, because the mantra is something beautiful. You hear the sound of the mantra and it energizes you. It reminds you of Manjushri's qualities. I don't have a translation of the mantra. I'm sorry. If anybody comes up with one, let me know. But, you know, you see or you hear the things around you, you know, you practice conceptually thinking of those things as beautiful sounds. And so again, what it does is it stops the judgmental critical mind that is saying, I don't like this sound and I like that one, and how come this person doesn't talk this way, and how come, you know, this and how come that. Okay. Also, the thing about seeing all sentient beings as Manjushri is then when somebody cuts in front of you in the lunch line, instead of getting angry because they cut in front, you say, I offer my place to Manjushri. And when your roommate doesn't clean up the bathroom, instead of getting angry, you say, Manjushri used the bathroom, a little bit dirtier than I thought Manjushri was. You know, his hair was supposed to be all tied up and now it's lying in the shower. But, you know, you think, okay, I'm going to offer something nice and, you know, clean up after Manjushri. And, you know, so you think that you're offering service to Manjushri, and then you don't get in quarrels with your roommate. Yeah? You notice the hair is blue, by the way. So you just change your attitude towards the people around you. And then when it says to see all thoughts as, you know, Manjushri's omniscient mind, it doesn't mean that when you sit there and start craving chocolate that you say, oh, this is his omniscient mind, you know, better please Buddha's mind and get some chocolate ASAP. You know, when you see your mind going on trips and obsessing about things, it's not like you say, that's wisdom, that's the Buddha's mind. But what it does is just by you know, when you look at your thoughts, if you start thinking, you know, Manjushri's omniscient mind, a couple of things. One is it can bring you back to the idea of, okay, I should try and make my mind like Manjushri's omniscient mind and stop paying attention to all this chatter and rubbish that's in it. Or another way of looking at it is Manjushri's mind would see the emptiness of all of those thoughts. You know, Manjushri's mind would just see the thoughts as, you know, total dependent arising, as in, you know, empty, and not take them as so serious. So, you know, when you have all these weird thoughts going through your mind, because everybody does, even though everybody thinks they're the only one that has them, you know, when all these are going through, just realize, you know, these are, you know, little karmic bubbles created by causes and conditions, and don't grasp onto them, just let them go. Okay, so that practice of, you know, seeing yourself and the sentient beings and the environment as Manjushri and the Pure Land, thinking of all the sounds as mantra, you know, relating to everything you hear in a positive way, and thinking of, you know, seeing all thoughts as Manjushri's pure, you know, pure mind, then what this does is it acts as a preventative measure for our own mind. And then instead of projecting negativity or projecting inherent existence, we are constantly reminding ourselves of emptiness. Yeah? And then if somebody comes and criticizes you, instead of getting mad at them, just think, Manjushri is pointing my faults out to me. Oh, and that can be very beneficial, because if you think it's your little brother pointing your faults out, you get angry because he's my little brother, you know, he should shut up. But if you think it's, you know, it's Manjushri saying the things, then we might actually stop and listen and, you know, pay some attention to what Manjushri is saying. And so that prevents us from getting angry. Okay, so these are all methods to help us tame our mind and transform our mind. Okay, so again, don't make these methods inherently existent. Because I see some people at the very beginning and, you know, okay, I'm doing retreat. Everybody's Manjushri. They're all walking around with golden bodies. You know, they're all saying Omarapatsanadi. You know, and the whole environment is, you know, twinkling with things. And they're just seeing it, you know, they're projecting some inherently existent Disneyland on everything. And that's not what we're trying to do. Okay? Yeah.
oh, the world, everything is perfect. Oh, it's all perfect. Ooh. You know, we're not trying to do that. Yeah. We're just trying to protect our mind from negativity, not to project some inherently existent Pure Land. Okay, so, you know, there we are as Manjushri. We invoke the wisdom beings. Yeah, we send out either golden light or blue light from the home at our heart that invokes the wisdom beings from all the Pure Lands and from the space of emptiness. They all come back in the form of Manjushri. That becomes the Manjushri in front of us, that comes in our head, that absorbs into us, that merges with us, and then that becomes undifferentiatable. And that's when we say Sahom Bam Ho. And that absorption of the wisdom beings into us is a way of actually convincing ourselves that our visualization is inhabited by the real wisdom beings, the real Manjushris, that it's not just our visualization. And then we do the offerings and praise. So the offering, you know, Om Arya Wagishara Sapariwari. Arya is the noble, you know, the supreme one. In other words, path of seeing and higher. Wagishara is Manjushri's name. Sapariwari means and everybody else, so all the other Buddhas. Then you offer argon, you know, water to drink, padyam, water to wash the feet, because in ancient India, this is what you offered guests when they came. Pupe, which is flowers. Dupe, incense. Aloke, light. Gende, perfume. Nude, food. And shabda, music. And then you ring your bell at that point. You don't use the drum in this practice because it's Kriya Tantra. And Parchitsahong Soha means like please accept and enjoy. Okay, so we make the offerings. When we do the offerings, we imagine offering goddesses emerging from our heart, you know, with all these beautiful offerings. And since here the offering is being made to ourself as Manjushri, the offering goddesses emerge from our heart holding these beautiful offerings, turn around and offer them to us, and we accept them and experience bliss. Okay, and then the goddesses dissolve back into us. So this is another way of remembering emptiness, because all these goddesses are coming from our own mind. They're emanating from the seed syllable at our heart. They're performing functions, and then they're dissolving into the seed syllable at our heart. So, you know, dependent arising things come and they go, and, you know, they're not solid and existent. And neither are all these offerings. So when we think of the offerings, they have three qualities. Their essence is empty. Their nature is emptiness. Their aspect is the individual offering. Their nature is emptiness. Their aspect is the individual offering, you know, water or fruit or light or all these beautiful things. And their function is to give supreme bliss. So when the goddesses turn around and offer you these things, you as Manjushri enjoy them. And then similarly in the break time, whatever you use, you think that it's being offered to you by goddesses. Okay? And so when you eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you are eating blissful wisdom nectar. And so as you eat the food, it produces a sense of real bliss and satisfaction. And it can be very interesting in your practice to practice feeling bliss and satisfaction. You know, it sounds great, but when you try and do it, you sometimes realize that you have no idea what bliss feels like. Yeah, we talk about bliss, but what in the world does bliss feel like? You know, and satisfaction, who has ever felt satisfied before? Yeah, and it's like a koan, you know, our tantric koan is, you know, because you're eating, for example, or when you dress in the morning, you imagine that, you know, as you put on your clothes, you're off, you know, it's Manjushri putting on these celestial silks, and the you know, the contact of the silk against your, you know, your rainbow body produces bliss. When you're taking a shower, you know, the water on your rainbow body, it's nectar producing bliss as it falls on your body. Okay? So every sense contact that you have, instead of producing attachment, yeah, and duality and craving and grasping and discontent, because we want more and better, we practice feeling bliss and satisfied with every single sense perception. That this is a whole practice in itself, isn't it? You know, just to be aware enough so that when you touch something or when you eat something, that you practice letting yourself feel satisfied. So whatever is around you, you feel satisfied with it. You look at it and it's beautiful and you feel totally blissed out and satisfied. And you train your mind, you practice. This is the chief practice of the break time, is to let yourself be happy. Yeah? I mean, because our dualistic mind is always saying, I want to be happy, I want to be happy. But its whole modus operandi creates unhappiness and misery, doesn't it? Because the dualistic mind is always saying, oh, I ate this, but it's not good enough, I want some more. How come they don't make it better? And they should do this better. And this, you know, oh, I got this new thing, but look, it's torn, and that thing's dirty, and this one isn't clean enough. And, oh, the shower feels too good, but the water's too hot, or, you know, I really need a new shower head because it doesn't, you know, I want one of those pulsating ones, or always, you know, the mind has some kind of commentary about how everything can be better than it is. And, you know, in retreat and just in your basic Dharma life, what you're trying to do is cut that dissatisfied mind and just love whatever it is that you're experiencing at the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, and just practice being satisfied and happy. So this is a very new, unconventional, highest, best, exotic practice. Yeah. That you all should do as much as possible. And especially with ourself. You know, practice being satisfied with yourself. Instead of always this critical, judgmental mind saying, oh, what I did isn't good enough, and somebody else is better than me, and I did this, but it wasn't perfect, and I should do it again, and how come this, and how come that, and, you know, I really need to rewrite that, and I need to paint this differently, and, oh, I almost hit that other car, and, you know, always, you know, criticizing ourselves. We're never satisfied with ourselves. Just to practice, you know, what I did is good enough. Yeah? Just practice being a little bit compassionate with ourselves. It doesn't mean being lazy and self-indulgent. It just means stopping this, you know, ridiculous critical mind. Okay? So this is how you should practice. Imagine practicing being satisfied with yourself. Try that one, okay? This week? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Homework for this week? That's right. Take out your yellow markers. So that when you come to class next week, you go, oh, you don't have to say, oh, look, I blew it and I forgot to do my homework. I'm such a dum-dum. You know. Try and do it. Okay, so we make the offerings, and then we do the praise. And so this praise, again, the goddesses emerge from our heart, and they all turn around, and they say these three verses to us. You know, so there you are, Manjushri, and, you know, all these goddesses are saying to you, I make obeisance to your youthful form, O Manjushri, like that of a dynamic and graceful 16-year-old. You repose upon the full moon as your cushion at the center of an expansive milk-white lotus. Okay, so that's praise to Manjushri's body. So all these goddesses, you know, are reminding you of who you are, your new identity, you know. 16 years old, you're not perimenopausal anymore. So there you are, 16 years old, dynamic and graceful, okay? You know, the full moon is your cushion. That represents the method or compassion side of the path. The lotus represents the wisdom side of the path. So it's method and wisdom combined, and you're sitting on top of that, okay? In this beautiful golden body that radiates light spontaneously with this incredible blissful expression on your face. And this is like really one of the beautiful things when, you know, when we get to the point about doing the meditation on the clear appearance of yourself as Manjushri, is that you meditate and you imagine yourself having Manjushri's face, and it's so beautiful and it looks happy. You know, how often when we think of ourselves, do we think of ourselves with a happy face? Not with a kind of happy, but, you know, just a pleasant look on our face, you know, a beautiful kind of countenance. How often do we think of ourselves, is our self-image, thinking of ourselves as looking like that? Okay, so here we're trying to cultivate that. And really, the more you do it, then the more your self-image changes and the more you start having a beautiful expression on your face. And then the second verse, I make obeisance to your speech, O mighty fulfiller of wishes, so manifluent to the minds of countless sentient beings, a lucent euphony to accord with each listener's capacity. I never passed English. Oh, I'm sure I'm satisfied with myself. It's multiplicity embellishing the hearing of all fortunate ones. Isn't that a beautiful verse? That verse is so beautiful. So that is to the speech of, you know, Manjushri's speech. Okay? So, fulfiller of wishes, because the Buddha's speech fulfills the wishes of sentient beings, because it teaches them how to be liberated from cyclic existence. Yeah? Actually, Manjushri's name in Tibetan is Jompa Lyang. Okay? So, Jom means smooth. So, you know, our disturbing attitudes are like thorns, but Manjushri's mind is beyond all these thorny preconceptions. And yang means vowel, okay? Vowel, like as in consonant and vowel, okay? Because all sound depends on vowels, so it's emphasizing that Manjushri is the essence of Buddhist speech. You know, he really represents Buddhist speech. And that's probably because, you know, he's the wisdom aspect, and so emphasizing giving teachings, you know, because giving teachings, hearing teachings is the basis of getting the realizations. And then, so that's Jom, that was the Jom and the Yang, and the Pel in the middle system, the middle syllable, Jom Pel Yang, means magnificent, you know, so the magnificent body, speech, and mind. Okay, so especially the speech fulfills all wishes, not because it praises you and says, oh, you're such a good meditator, but because, you know, Manjushri teaches you how to be free of cyclic existence. Yeah? So, manifluent? Boy. You know, very smooth and sweet to the minds of countless sentient beings. So whenever, you know, Manjushri speaks, you know, it's coming from such a positive motivation and such skillful means that, you know, it's just conveys this goodness in it. And so anybody who hears it, you know, hears it with happiness. Yeah, wouldn't that be nice so that whenever anybody heard your voice, they were happy? You know, whenever anybody heard your voice on the other end of the telephone, instead of going, oh God, this one again, they actually said, oh wow, so nice to talk to you. Yeah? So to think of, you know, making our speech like that. Yeah, a loosened ethony to accord with each listener's capacity. So the Buddha, whenever the Buddha speaks, accords with the tendencies, the dispositions of each disciple, you know, saying whatever is appropriate to that particular individual, not giving teachings that are either too easy or too complex or not appropriate or whatever, but really, you know, being able to suss people out and teach them, you know, according to their disposition. And it's multiplicity embellishing the hearing of all fortunate ones. So multiplicity, you know, when you're Buddha, you can teach so many different paths, now give so many different teachings, because you see the different tendencies and dispositions of people. So you have a very big mind. And I think that, you know, understanding this is really important for us, you know, because sometimes when we practice the Dharma, we get a little bit patriotic about our own particular tradition, you know, kind of rah-rah, you know, well, first it's rah-rah Buddhism, okay, and then rah-rah Tibetan Buddhism, and then rah-rah Galupa, and then rah-rah DFF, and at the end it's rah-rah me, isn't it? That it always comes down to. But realizing, okay, you know, this is what works for me, this is what speaks to my heart and invigorates me. But Buddha, you know, there's so many different dispositions and different tendencies of sentient beings, and so there's going to be a lot of different spiritual traditions. And within Buddhism, a lot of different, you know, Buddhist paths. And within, you know, any particular path, a lot of different teachers. And within the disciples of one teacher, a lot of different ways of hearing and interpreting what's going on. And so having that kind of big mind, then, you know, we can still discern what speaks to our heart and what fits best for us, so that we don't get completely diluted running here. Diluted, not diluted. Diluted, you know, just kind of spread too thin because we're running all over the place. We don't get that. We're able to stay on track, but we're also able to respect other people's paths and teachers and so on, even though they may not be, you know, something that speaks to our heart. We can see that it benefits those particular sentient beings, so we rejoice. And so then, instead of competing with other people, either people of other religions or people of different Buddhist traditions, or even, you know, people competing with other disciples, or competing, you know, my teacher's better than your teacher kind of stuff, you know, we don't get involved in any of that waste of time. Yeah. But we have a big mind, and we see, you know, Buddha teaches in different ways for different people. And we're lucky we found something that suits us, and we hope everybody else finds something that's suitable for them. But we don't need to compete with everybody else. Yeah, we don't need to all prove to them that, you know, our brand is the real one, and our teacher is the best one, and our practice, and, you know. Okay. So there's some kind of space. I think that's very important. If you don't want to practice this, I invite you to go live on the border of Israel and Palestine. Okay? And then the third verse, O Manjushri, I make obeisance to your mind, wherein is illuminated the entire tapestry of the myriad objects of knowledge. It is a tranquil ocean of unfathomable profundity, of immeasurable breadth, boundless like space itself. Okay, so that verse is prostration to Manjushri's mind. Okay, I make obeisance to your mind, where is illuminated the entire tapestry of the myriad objects of knowledge. Yeah. So the Buddha's mind has two kinds of wisdom. There's the wisdom of varieties and the wisdom of the mode. Okay? The wisdom of varieties is the wisdom that perceives all conventional truths. So the variety of all the conventional truths. The wisdom that perceives the mode of existence of all these conventional truths. Their mode of existence is that they're empty. So with these two wisdoms, the Buddha's mind perceives all existent phenomena. You know, the conventional phenomena and their emptinesses simultaneously. So that's something that only a Buddha can do. Even when you're, you know, like an 8th, 9th, or 10th Bhumi Bodhisattva, you might be able to perceive a lot of conventionalities, but not quite all. And when you're perceiving conventional phenomena directly, at the same time, you don't have the direct realization of emptiness. But when you enter into meditative equipoise as one of these Arya Bodhisattvas, then you perceive the emptiness of all phenomena, but at that time you can't simultaneously perceive their bases, the conventional truths, the conventional phenomena. So, you know, a bodhisattva, high-level bodhisattva, is always going back and forth between meditative equipoise on emptiness and subsequent realization, whereby they perceive phenomena as illusions. The phenomena still appear to them as truly existent, but they realize that they don't exist as they appear, and that those appearances are illusory. So in post-meditation practice, you know, you practice seeing things as illusions, as like illusions, and then in meditative equipoise, seeing them directly, seeing their emptiness directly. Okay? So only high-level bodhisattvas actually do this. The rest of us practice a similitude of this. In other words, we pretend, you know, because we're trying to build up the causes to get to the path of seeing where we can actually do it. Yeah? If we don't build up the causes and pretend, we won't ever get there. But, you know, so even from the path of seeing onward, yeah, still you can't have the two truths in your mind at one time. Yeah, or actually in highest yoga tantra you can, but you can't sustain it for very long. But the thing is that only the Buddha can perceive both, you know, the mode of existence, emptiness, and the varieties of conventional phenomena simultaneously, you know, and see them in a non-contradictory way, because from the Buddha's own side, there's no appearance of inherent existence. And so therefore, a Buddha's able to see the two truths, conventional truths and ultimate truths simultaneously, without seeing them, you know, in ways that contradict each other. So when it says, where is illuminated the entire tapestry of the myriad objects of knowledge, there it's referring to, you know, the wisdom of varieties, where the Buddha, you know, sees the variety of conventional truths. It is a tranquil ocean of unfathomable profundity. You know, that's showing the wisdom of the mode that it perceives the emptiness of all of these phenomena. Okay, directly. Of immeasurable breadth, boundless like space itself. Okay, so the Buddha's wisdom is, you know, something immeasurable, yeah, boundless, immeasurable, inconceivable. You know, actually, when they say inconceivable, what it means is, you know, the ability to perceive the two truths simultaneously, directly. Now, that's inconceivable for limited beings like us, because we don't actually even perceive the conventional truths as they really are, or the ultimate truths as they really are. Okay? I mean, that's how way out of whack we are. So, you know, when you're reciting these verses, you're thinking of Manjushri's qualities, and you're thinking that you have those qualities now. So by thinking like this, it gives you some direction as to what kind of qualities you're trying to develop, and then you start thinking, well, you know, Manjushri sees the emptiness of all phenomena. What does seeing the emptiness of all phenomena directly mean? Okay? And so that sets you into a meditation on emptiness. And then you think, well, you know, the Buddha, the Manjushri sees all conventional, you know, truths, you know, this whole tapestry of conventional truths. Well, what is seeing, you know, how does a Buddha see conventional truths? How do they appear, you know? Like illusions. Well, what does that mean, seeing things as like illusions? And why do they call it a conventional truth anyway if it's a falsity? Yeah? conventional truths don't exist the way they appear, how come they're called truths? So it sets you into a whole way of thinking and examining. Okay? So these verses of praise are things to instigate your curiosity and to also help you change your self-image, because as you think of the meaning of these things, the more you understand them, then the more you actually have them, so to speak. Okay? And then after that, after you do the praise and offerings, then there's no words in the sadhana, but that's actually where you stop and do a big long meditation. Okay, you don't zip on to the mantra recitation right away. And so you stop and meditate on that point. And this is like in the Chenrezig sadhana when we did, we talked about developing clear appearance and divine identity. Okay, so we want to do the meditation, you know, to develop those two things. So this is actually the core part of the meditation. The mantra recitation, we spend a lot of time doing that, but that's basically because we're baby beginners. So, you know, when you first do a retreat, you mostly emphasize the mantra because we can't meditate very well. But actually, as you do the retreat more and more and get better and better at meditation, then the mantra becomes merely what you say to relax your mind and not the core of your retreat. And the basic meditation is what you do right here at this point where there's no words telling you to do it. Okay? But what you do is you stop and you develop the clear appearance of yourself as Manjushri. And you meditate on that. And that helps you to develop calm abiding or concentration. So you start off, you might go through the details of Manjushri's body, not in too great of detail. You don't want to get too hung up on it. But you want to get a general image of yourself as Manjushri, and then you hold your mind on that general image. Some days all you may get is some kind of golden or orange blob, you know. That's good enough. But as you practice developing concentration on this more and more, then it gets clearer. So this is one of the special techniques in Tantra, because you're developing calm abiding and samadhi on the image of yourself as the deity. So this is a very special meditation object, because, you know, you're going to develop concentration, but by developing it on the image of yourself as the deity, you're going to do some drastic rearranging of your self-image in the process of it. Okay? So it's very, very profound. It has a lot of, you know, ripple effects in your practice. So you go through and you do a general analysis of the different features of Manjushri, and then you just hold that in your mind, okay, that image of yourself as Manjushri. If it starts to fade, then you go through and you remember, yeah, the eyes look like this and the mouth looks like that. And remember I was saying, you know, you're imagining yourself with this beautiful expression on your mouth. So it doesn't mean that you have to sit there with a stupid grin on your face in meditation. But, you know, you imagine having a pleasant expression on your face, and it's going to change your mood. Guaranteed it's going to change your mood. Yeah, and you know, and there you are wearing these magnificent silks, yeah, and you didn't even have to kill any silkworms to get them, so they're environmentally friendly, yeah. With your sword, your double-edged sword, hewing down suffering and wrong conceptions and illness, and holding your lotus with the Prajnaparamita text, being able to teach all the sentient beings. And that's, you know, you develop that as the image. Yeah. So when you're meditating to develop calm abiding, you still meditate as it teaches in the sutra. In other words, you still have the same five obstacles, and you still practice the same eight antidotes. So this is explained in the Lam Rim in the chapter in calm abiding. Just to review, the five obstacles. The first one is laziness. Second one is forgetting the object. Third is laxity and excitement. Fourth is not applying the antidote. And fifth is over-applying the antidote. Okay, so these kind of arise in order as we're meditating, and we have to apply the counteractive forces to them. So what laziness means is that we, you know, we have no interest in developing concentration. So we basically run through this part of the practice, and because there's no words there, we pretend it doesn't exist, we don't do the meditation. Okay, we're lazy. So to remedy that, we have to develop faith. And what faith or confidence here means is in, you know, it is in the good effects of calm abiding and being able to have that kind of state of mind that can concentrate on an object at will, you know, and place it there and not have it get distracted. So the first antidote is that faith or confidence in the benefit of calm abiding. Second antidote, also to laziness, is that then you develop aspiration to develop calm abiding. Third is effort, so you have the effort to develop calm abiding. And then fourth is called pliancy or flexibility. And this is a mental factor that is a serviceability of body and mind so that it can stay focused on the object for as long as you want. So these four, yeah, the faith, aspiration, effort, and pliancy or flexibility. Those are all antidotes to the first one, which is laziness. Then the second one, the second hindrance, forgetting the instruction. What this means is either you've forgotten the instructions on how to meditate on calm abiding, or you've forgotten your object of meditation. So you've sat there, you know, visualized yourself as Manjushri, and then all of a sudden you're thinking about your boyfriend, you know, or your girlfriend, or your dog, or your frog, or your boss, or whoever it is, okay? But your mind is off on something else. So at that time, the antidote to that is memory or mindfulness, and this is a mental factor that that is able to remember an object in such a way that your mind doesn't get distracted from it. So you, especially at the beginning of your meditation, you have to have very strong memory or mindfulness. You know, you have to know what your meditation object is and have a clear image of that as much as you can, even though it may not be perfect. And then some kind of firmly remembering that, firmly placing your mind on that. That's what the mindfulness is. If you do that well at the beginning, then it's, you know, your meditation is going to have more stability because your mind will be on the object. It won't be so, you know, so shifting. It won't be so easy for distractions to occur. Then the third distraction, actually it's two, but they're lumped into one, is called laxity and excitement. So what this is excitement is the mind that is distracted towards objects of attachment. So you're sitting there, you know, you've gotten over laziness, so you're there on the cushion, yeah, you've stopped at this part of the sadhana to meditate. You've visualized yourself as Manjushri, you have mindfulness, you're remembering that image of yourself as Manjushri. And then you think about chocolate. Okay, and the mind gets excited about chocolate or about the job you want to get or about the place you want to go on holiday or about, you know, the new jewelry you're going to get or whatever it is, okay? So excitement is the mind that goes off towards objects of attachment. So again, you lose the object. Laxity is a kind of dullness of the mind, yeah? It has subtle and gross forms. You know, the very grossest form is you fall asleep in your meditation. A little less gross is your mind's just kind of, you know, slightly foggy or, you know, not quite clear. And then there's also a very subtle kind of laxity where you have clarity and stability in your meditation, but your clarity is not very intense. So there's a lack of intensity of the clarity. And many people are not able to realize that in their meditation, and they think that they've attained calm abiding, but in actual fact, they have subtle laxity in the mind. So the texts and the masters always really warn against that. Okay. In our level, we probably don't have to worry about that. We're more worried about staying awake during the meditation session, okay? But the antidote to those two things, and you see how one, the excited mind is like too hyped up, and the dull mind is too slowed down, okay? The antidote to both of those is a mental factor called introspective alertness. And what that one does, it's like a little spy, and it pops up from time to time, and it just checks, am I concentrating, or, you know, have I fallen into excitement, have I fallen into laxity? Now, of course, there's other distractions besides those two. Those are kind of the big ones, but we may also fall into anger, and you may also find, you know, that you're not distracted so much by objects of attachment, but you're always getting angry in your meditation, and your mind's always complaining, you know? Every time you sit down to meditation, you know, you can't even get to the bliss of thinking about chocolate and your boyfriend because you're too hung up about complaining and getting angry at the people around you. Okay? So that's another kind of distraction. It's not mentioned specifically here, but any of these are the ones that, you know, fall under this third step. So we have to notice them if they've arisen in our meditation and then apply the counteractive measures. So if we're falling asleep, you know, we need to wake up, check our posture, make sure our eyes are a little bit open, get some exercise in the break time. You usually think that the antidote is going to sleep in the break time, but not necessarily. You have to see. Sometimes you need to sleep, but sometimes what you need is to get exercise. Splash your head with cold water, wear fewer clothes, your body's a little bit cooler. That'll help you stay awake. Don't eat so much. Yeah, these are all things that can help you stay awake. Or think, if it gets really bad, then stop your meditation. Think about something that uplifts your mind, like precious human life or the qualities of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, something like that. So all that uplifts the mind. It's very good against when the mind is low energy. When the mind is too excited, then you're holding the object too tightly, so you need to relax your mind a little bit and, you know, bring your mind back to the object of meditation. If you keep doing that but it keeps getting distracted, then again you need to pause from that meditation and think about something that's going to sober your mind, like death and impermanence or the lower realms or the disadvantages of cyclic existence, something like that. Okay? So in that way you learn to become a doctor to your own mind, you know? Whatever's going on, if your mind's off balance, you know what to meditate on to bring it back into balance. If you're having a lot of complaining mind and angry mind, then meditate on patience. Yeah, do all those meditations. Okay, then the fourth one is not applying the antidote. So that is, you've noticed that, you know, you have, let's say, excitement, but you don't apply the antidote because you're really enjoying this daydream. Yeah? Or you've noticed that your mind's getting dull, but, you know, you might say, well, you know, I didn't sleep very much last night. Might as well make up for it in this meditation session, you know. So you don't apply the antidote. So the counteractive measure for that is applying the antidote. Okay? And then the fifth hindrance is over-applying the antidote, which means that, you know, you've brought your mind back into balance, but you keep applying the antidote. So that's like a parent, you know, their kid's finally behaving, but they keep on reprimanding him. So, you know, the antidote to that is equanimity. Just be cool. Okay, so you know, you're developing calm abiding here on yourself as the deity, but you use those same methods for managing your mind as you practice in the sutra. Huh? So it's good to study that in the long run. Okay, so you're developing the clarity of yourself as the deity, and what this counteracts is ordinary appearance. So ordinary appearance has two aspects, the appearance of true existence and the appearance of things being ordinary. So, you know, the appearance of things being ordinary would be like, I'm just little old me, I can't do things very well anyway. So by visualizing yourself as Manjushri, instead of as appearing as little old me, you're appearing as Manjushri. So it's counteracting that appearance. And then also, you know, the other aspect of ordinary appearance is that it appears as truly existent or inherently existent. So here you're trying to have the image of yourself as Manjushri appear as like an illusion. Yeah? In other words, not as something truly existent, but something dependently arising. So that counteracts the ordinary appearance. And then the second thing you're trying to develop in this part of the meditation, in the first one was the clear appearance. The second one is the divine identity or divine dignity of yourself as the deity. And that is identifying with yourself as the deity. So, you know, you're not only imagining yourself as Manjushri, but you're saying, this is me. Not an inherently existent me, just a conventionally appearing me, yeah. But you're identifying with that. And so what that develops this sense of divine dignity. It develops a new self-image. So instead of, you know, always saying the mantra, I'm so stupid, I'm incapable, I make a mess of everything, you're saying a new mantra, which is, you know, I'm Manjushri, and, you know, I'm kind of a nice person. I'm compassionate, and I'm considerate, and I'm wise. And, you know, you're developing a good self-image. And so what that divine dignity or divine identity counteracts is the ordinary grasping. So again, ordinary grasping, like ordinary appearance,